Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what looks like a successful effort by the Attorney General, William Barr, to contain the potential damage of the Mueller report by writing his own summary, which frames the results to the public in a way that exonerates Trump, even if that was not Mueller's intention. Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she has an article, It Ain't Over Till It's Over, What's Next for the Mueller Report, joins us to discuss the extent to which Barr has rescued the Republican brand, which could have been severely damaged by an indictment of the GOP's leader ahead of the 2020 elections. We'll assess how difficult it has been for prosecutors to show ill intent on the president's behalf in terms of obstruction of justice when Trump is so public with his outbursts and attacks in claiming he could shoot someone in broad daylight and get away with it, and with his call out to the Russians to help him by hacking Hillary Clinton's emails. We'll also explore what strategies the Democratic chairs of House committees investigating Trump can employ to get around Republican charges that the Democrats are petty and vindictive, pursuing witch hunts even though Trump has been exonerated. Then we'll speak with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is What Mueller's Apparent Dud Means for Democrats. He joins us to discuss Trump's continuing attacks on the Mueller probe, even though the so-called witch hunt and illegal coup failed to materialize at the hands of the much maligned Mueller, who was portrayed as the poster boy of the deep state. With Republicans buoyed and Democrats on the defensive, Eric argues that nevertheless, what didn't kill Trump's presidency won't necessarily make it stronger in 2020. Then finally, Shibli Tilhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Trump is too pro-Netanyahu for his own base, following a photo op in the White House today with Donald Trump. Prime Minister Netanyahu had to hurry back home to deal with rocket attacks from Gaza by Hamas. And we'll assess how much Trump's widespread popularity in Israel will rub off on the legally embattled Netanyahu ahead of the close election in 2 weeks, in which the Prime Minister faces the centrist blue-white coalition of former Army Chiefs of Staff. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and she's the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she has an article at the American Constitution Society, It Ain't Over Till It's Over, What's Next for the Mueller Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Fredrickson.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Caroline. And I must say that Bill Barr appears to me to have pulled off an amazing stunt here where he's literally saved the Republican brand by essentially taking over the Mueller report. And my understanding is that Mueller had initially wanted to indict Trump for obstruction of justice, and they negotiated and came up with this compromise where they couldn't indict him or didn't rise to the level of corrupt intent, but on the other hand, they didn't exonerate him, this kind of nothing burger, as some have called it. Do you think that that's a possibility, that this is a guy who auditioned for the job essentially to sort of save the Republican brand in 2020?
Well, I mean, it's clear he auditioned for the job. I mean, he wrote a memo that said essentially the whole idea of obstruction is misconceived when it comes to the president. The president, in essence, is above the law. The president cannot be accused of obstruction. So you've got the other piece of this, though, is also that the Department of Justice has a policy, which many people disagree with, but it's a policy that says that the president can't be indicted while in office. So these two things working together make it clear that Barr had a strong interest in creating an understanding for the broader public that the president had not, in fact, committed a crime, the underlying crime of conspiracy, or worked to engage in obstruction. But it's actually clear, even from his letter, self-serving as it is, that Bob Mueller might have well thought otherwise, because, as the letter says, Bob Mueller just did not reach a conclusion because the issues of law and fact were so difficult. In my mind, that means Bob Mueller found a lot of evidence of obstruction, and Bill Barr determined himself that that was not obstruction worthy of pursuing.
Well, it is. It seems to me that not only is this good for the Republican brand, it would have been pretty hard for them had their president or the leader of their party been indicted. And now you can see what their tactic will be with all of these House investigations. Mm-hmm. They're basically going to be saying, well, why are you Democrats wasting all taxpayers' money on this witch hunt? Isn't this just like your sort of petty and vindictive behavior vis-a-vis Kavanaugh in the hearings, which many people think backfired? I mean, here we have today Liz Cheney, who's the House GOP conference chair, saying the American people will long remember how wrong and irresponsible the Democrats have been. As we go forward, it's time for the Democrats to put aside their partisan agenda of attacking the president and instead focus on addressing the real issues facing the American people. So that's going to be their House. Nadler and all these other House chairs are going to proceed with the many investigations, including Adam Schiff.
Well, I mean, number one, they need to just shut that down. It's ridiculous. I mean, after all, this investigation has resulted in a large number of guilty pleas, guilty verdicts, many indictments, has uncovered substantial evidence that the Russians interfered in our election. This is not a witch hunt, and we've got to, that is absolutely has to be rejected. The other piece is that, you know, clearly the obstruction question, even for this administration's hand-picked attorney general, was left as an open question. That is absolutely what Congress needs to look at. That is, in fact, what happened in Watergate. There was no finding of obstruction. It was a question sent to the House of Representatives to investigate, and that's exactly what should happen here. The House needs to get into the issues. They need to ask Bill Barr. They need to ask Bob Mueller, what were those difficult questions? What are those difficult questions of fact and law? What was the standard of proof you were looking at that you were using to evaluate this? Did you decide not that it wasn't that there was would be no indictments because of the DOJ policy, or because you actually thought that the president was did not commit an act, a criminal act worthy of an indictment? So I think those are really significant questions. And what we have here is the fact that Bob Mueller did not exonerate this president on the issue of obstruction. We also have the issue of conspiracy, which was very narrowly drawn, did not look at the issues of conspiring with Russian nationals to influence the election through or other matters through quid pro quo means, that is, by giving the Russians polling data, by getting from the Russians information that was harmful to Hillary Clinton. Exchanges that were clearly should have been considered as part of a conspiracy that were obviously not included in the underlying investigation. So I think there are a lot of questions that Congress has got to probe, and that's their job. That's what the Article 1 of the Constitution says that Congress is supposed to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, who's the president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and she's the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she has an article at the American Constitutional Society, It Ain't Over Till It's Over, What's Next for the Mueller Report. Of course, I think Donald Trump was clever saying no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. And one of the things that's extraordinary about him is that he sort of does everything in the open. There's nothing furtive about him. You know, so I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. I don't know whether this is the constitutional equivalent of shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue, but many, many examples, all of his business dealings. There's so many books being written about. This is what's so frustrating. If you read all of the books by Seth Hettner, Craig Unger, Greg Miller of the Washington Post, it's extraordinary how much Russian money laundering has passed through his hands and all the condo has been built and his long relationship with the Russians. It's just beyond belief. And even Lindsey Graham said today that the Russians did hack into the DNC and they hacked into Podesta, and it wasn't a 400-pound guy sitting in a basement. So, you know, here he is, Trump, saying, Russia, if you're listening, and yet, do you think that's one of the reasons why he gets away with things, that he's just so brazen?
Well, absolutely. It seems to be ultimately one of the grounds for determining that there was no conspiracy, that there was no obstruction, that it was all so public. And that strikes me as ridiculous. You know, if somebody beats somebody up on the street, you wouldn't say that just because they did it in front of a cop means that it's not something that they could be arrested for. It's still assault, public or not. And that's the same issue here. If you're trying to intimidate a witness, you know, if you're the president, you know that you have the bully pulpit and you can do it very well by broadcasting it. You know, you can talk to the Russians and they'll be hearing you when you say, you know, go ahead and release those emails. And so, you know, I think it's true that he's unabashed and unembarrassed to engage in obstruction publicly, but, you know, it's still obstruction.
So you mentioned a minute ago, Caroline Frederickson, Watergate, and of course we are in a different era now. We're much, much more polarized there. I recall in Watergate, of course, one of the more trenchant statements came from the Republican senator from Tennessee. What did the president know and when did he know it? Without people like Howard Baker and with the sort of Tea Party type people that we have in the House on the Republican side and on the Senate, going forward, again, how do you think Schiff and Nadler and other people, these chairs, should handle it? Because we know what the criticism is going to be. He's already been exonerated. Why are you petty and vindictive Democrats wasting taxpayers' money?
Well, for one, he wasn't exonerated. So even Barr's letter specifically says the Mueller report does not exonerate the president. So let's put that aside. He was not exonerated. And the other reason is that the American public has to know that our elections are safe and that foreign governments have not been now invited in to the ballot booth with the American voter to help make a decision about who wins the presidency and other offices. They need to believe that their vote's sacred. And that whole issue, you know, is sort of where we all started on this, that it was clear that the Russians played a role. And we still don't have any response to that. So we need to know how it happened. What were those contacts? But we also, you know, for a nation that was established under rule of law, separation of powers and checks and balances, it's essential that the United States show that that its leaders are not above the law. And that means there needs to be a probe, even if, so if they find out and they agree that perhaps there wasn't a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, something that would prevail in a criminal proceeding in the courtroom, but there was highly unethical and inappropriate behavior by a president, then Congress needs to look at that and think about whether our laws are strong enough. Do we need something more than the expectation that a president won't engage in bullying behavior, won't use his office to advance his personal net worth? You know, those are all very important questions. Now, I think they need to do it carefully, thoughtfully, make it clear that this is to defend our democracy and rule of law. This is not a vendetta against Donald Trump as a person, no matter how much he might aggravate them. But these are critical questions for our democracy that have to be addressed and hopefully answered in some way that gives the American people confidence in our system.
And Caroline Frederickson, what do you make about some of the kind of backlash from the left of the Democratic Party, from people like Glenn Greenwald and others, and the editors of the Nation, who've always argued that this Russiagate was a witch hunt? I'm not sure what planet they're on. I mean, you know, the Russians didn't, during the Republican primaries, they didn't support Rick Santorum or John Kasich or any of that long list of candidates. They clearly supported one guy, and he's been the beneficiary of the hacks by the GRU, Russian military intelligence, and we've mentioned, at least in other interviews, it's so obvious that the data dumps were done at very strategic moments, just at, on the eve of the Democratic Convention, and then once the Access Hollywood tape came out, immediately thereafter, WikiLeaks dumped more incriminating emails to take that story off the headlines. I mean, what more proof do you need that, obviously you're not, I'm not saying that literally Putin was on the phone with Trump coordinating. That would not be how, and it is not how Russian intelligence works. But the idea that somehow not only are people on the right, Trump's supporters, giddy and celebrating, there are also people on the left who are also celebrating in their own way, that they feel that somehow, as Matt Taibbi has written, that this Mueller report finding will be the WMD of American journalism.
Well, with all due respect to Glenn Greenwald, I have to say that I think all of the intelligence agencies of the United States and foreign intelligence agencies, our allies, have all conclusively found that the Russians interfered in our election. We also know that Donald Trump asked publicly for help from the Russians. We know that Donald Trump got help from the Russians. And we know that the Russian help to Donald Trump gave him a boost in his Electoral College win. So I think the issue is, to the extent that there's not a finding that there was a conspiracy, it's because it wasn't beyond a reasonable doubt. That is, they didn't find the absolute rock-solid link that unites all those parties in one chain. It's a very high standard. Does that mean that there was that we shouldn't be investigating this? We know the Russians interfered in our election. We know Donald Trump solicited, help from the Russians. We know that the Russians did, in fact, provide help. Seems to me that was a pretty solid basis for an investigation that we should have all supported, and we should hope that it continues so that we actually make sure it doesn't happen again.
Well, just in closing, I'm trying to figure out if I'm correct in the assumption that William Barr was acting to sort of save the Republican brand in 2020. The consequences of a re-election of Trump will be the destruction of the American brand writ large around the world. We've already seen Trump's got a cabinet which is a team of grifters. There's a complete regulatory capture. If you look at the Boeing example, where the Secretary of Transportation, Mitch McConnell's wife, basically Elaine Chao, let Boeing test their own planes without any oversight. Now Boeing, which is the most successful American brand abroad, is in trouble. Nobody listens to our Secretary of State or our National Security Advisor, let alone Trump abroad. The world is retreating from America. Another 8 years, or 8 years in total, of denying global warming is something that the planet can't afford. And 4 more years of Trump, I think by that time, with him basically, he'll basically turn America into a banana republic, where, you know, his own family will be looting the treasury as they do in third world countries. That is the way I see America heading under another 4 years of Trump. And I'm surprised that establishment Republicans like William Barr think that somehow helping him skate is going to help America. I don't get it.
Well, I hope it's not going to be as depressing as you lay it out. There are many sort of formerly establishment Republicans like Bill Kristol and others who've been highly critical of this president and his kleptocracy. So, I'm not willing to throw in the towel entirely yet, but I do think it means that, the real refuge that we have, the real protection for our democracy is democracy. It's an election. It's for people to vote their values. And if they dislike, what they see in the White House, they need to choose someone else.
Well, I certainly am not recommending throwing in the towel. I think, the lesson is to fight harder. But
absolutely.
I just, I have to give the Republicans credit for pulling off a pretty a fast one in this case.
Indeed.
Well, okay, so and let's not end on a depressing note.
No.
I thank you for joining us, Caroline Fredrickson.
It's really always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Caroline. And again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, who's the president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil rights and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. And she previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and she's the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. And she has an article at the American Constitution Society, It Ain't Over Till It's Over, What's Next for the Mueller Report. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether what didn't kill Trump's presidency won't necessarily make it stronger in 2020.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me. I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Police and thieves in the street. Oh yes, scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition. But the next generation will be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is What Mueller's Apparent Dud Means for Democrats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Levitz.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Eric. And it does look, at least to my mind, that William Barr has really saved the Republican brand for 2020, that I don't know what exactly went on, but there are rumors that some time back Mueller told Barr that he was planning on indicting Trump for obstruction of justice, and then they negotiated and they came up with this ridiculous compromise where they weren't going to charge him, but on the other hand, they weren't going to exonerate him. But in general, Barr's intervention and essentially taking over from Mueller, which of course is the way it should be, because the only reason Mueller's there is because Sessions recused himself, it would mean that Barr's in charge. And it seems to me that this is a great gift to the Republicans. Do you think he's going to be able to bury it? Because he's got the Democrats sort of whining away, and every inquiry that the House begins against Trump will be dismissed by the Republicans as saying, why are you wasting taxpayer money? The president's already been cleared.
Yeah, I think that is the line that they're going to take. But I think that that was the line the Republicans were already taking about the Mueller investigation from almost day one. The argument that this is wasting precious resources and that this is presidential harassment has been prominent for months now, if not years. So I think that that is the line that they're going to play, and this does help them advance that line of critique. At the same time, I don't think that they'll be able to get away with not releasing the full report at some point. There's good reason for a certain period of time in which the Attorney General's office needs to redact the report for any, classified information, any sources. There's a legitimate reason why they're not immediately releasing the entire report. But if in 2 weeks they still have not made that report available to public inspection, then I think that there's going to be significant pressure and that it's ultimately going to get leaked. As far as whether this is a gift to the Republican Party, I think that there is reason to suspect that Barr framed this in a maximally convenient way from Donald Trump's perspective. At the same time, I'm personally skeptical that this fundamentally changes the outlook for 2020 in any significant way. As I wrote in my article, I think that it's right now, it's March 2019, and the speed at which the news cycle moves these days, the severity of the American public's amnesia suggests that this really is not going to fundamentally change what the race is going to look like. I mentioned in the article that, just reminding us that in early October 2016, the American public heard a tape of the Republican nominee confessing to grabbing women by their genitalia without permission on a regular basis because he's a star. Hillary Clinton briefly opened up a double-digit lead in opinion polls. Paul Ryan said that he would no longer defend the Republican nominee. His sole focus now was in trying to preserve the House from the impending landslide that polls were suggesting. And within about 2 weeks, voters forgot about that. Polls reverted back to their long-running average, and Donald Trump won the presidency. So if that big of a story was able to sort of die down within 2 weeks, I'm pretty confident that within, you know, a year, year and a half, that a notably uninteresting report from Robert Mueller is not going to be a significant factor.
Well, apropos of the Access Hollywood tape that you just mentioned, it's worth noting that within half an hour of that Trump taking that hit, WikiLeaks did this data dump of more and more hacked emails specifically to take that story, or at least to distract from that story. And that leads you to, even Lindsey Graham just said that the Russians hacked the DNC and they hacked the Podesta, and that it wasn't a 400-pound guy sitting in the basement somewhere. What's happening with all these people writing into me saying I owe an apology for being a Russian basher? I mean, how bizarre is that? Isn't it pretty clear that the Russians hacked the DNC, they hacked Podesta? They dumped these things at strategic moments ahead of the Democratic Convention. And as I just mentioned, just after the Access Hollywood tape did damage to Trump, they dumped something with the specific intent of distracting and diminishing the impact, the negative impact of Access Hollywood tape. I can go on with all the examples that we've had throughout this whole thing. I mean, obviously the Russians don't have their fingerprints on that. Why should they? They don't have to coordinate. I mean, all these low-level guys like Carter Page and company were just self-promoters, but the Russians weren't interested in using them. They didn't have to. They can do their own thing without coordinating and in collusion with Trump. It's just amazingly naive that people think that suddenly Putin and Trump are exonerated.
Right. Well, it's sort of contradictory as far as if you believe that Mueller's findings are sound such that, and it's sort of strange because it's really hard to prove a negative. And what we know is that Mueller did not feel that he had the evidence required to mount a credible legal prosecution for conspiracy to engage in these computer crimes or espionage or what have you, which is very different from saying that they did not happen. But even stipulating that, if we believe the claim from Barr's summary of Mueller's report that there was not evidence of direct coordination or collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian government agents, that same summary says that Russia aggressively intervened in the election. And so you can't, you know, accept that it's credible on the one score and not the other. It is now established fact from Mueller's report, although it sort of was already, that Russia did intervene on Trump's behalf during the 2016 election, and as you noted, that they hacked emails from the Democratic Party and released them very strategically. So that is without question, that's sort of unequivocal. Now the question is about the extent of Donald Trump's complicity in this operation, and that is, it is true that some people on the left, center left, did hype and create an expectation that there was a much better reason to believe that Mueller was going to be able to secure some kind of indictment or show proof that Trump played a direct role in orchestrating the computer, the hacking, or at least coordinated about when to release it, which always struck me and I think many other observers of the scandal as highly unlikely for a variety of reasons. One, just the how difficult that is to prove, the fact that collusion isn't actually a crime, and then just how unnecessary it would have been for them to directly coordinate in that manner. So yeah, I share your puzzlement at certain forms of the I told you so stuff going on right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Levitz, who writes for the New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is What Mueller's Apparent Dud Means for Democrats. And obviously there was a lot of breathlessness, particularly on MSNBC and other outlets. And a lot of people are so unhappy with Trump, embarrassed by him, appalled by him, etc. and I'm certainly in that category, that people have a natural tendency to hope that there's a magic bullet that will make him go away, as opposed to hard campaign with good candidates so that could beat him at the polls. And we've yet to see that emerge, at least as far as I can tell. And obviously, you know, taking a meeting with a bunch of Russians in Trump Tower is not a crime. Taking a meeting is not a crime. Acting on it is. So a lot of it was obvious that it was being blown up, or at least people were jumping to conclusions. But what I find particularly frustrating, Eric Levitz, is Trump's amazing. Everything about him is out there in the open. His criminality, his treachery, everything's out in the open. It always has been. I mean, if you read the books by really good reporters like Seth Hettner from the AP, Greg Miller from the Washington Post, Craig Unger, they've all done exhaustive documentation of Trump's decades-long relationships with Russian organized crime and how much they funded him buying condos, investing in Trump Soho, etc., and in laundering money through the Atlantic City casinos. It's just amazingly clear on the record who this guy is and what he's been up to. But that's all forgotten. I mean, maybe in a way Trump was incredibly clever to keep saying no collusion, no collusion, no collusion, because he knew that was the weakest case they had against him.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that, I mean, what we're talking about, you know, this president, he's had to settle very early in his after election, I believe, to settle the fact that he had created a fraudulent university and defrauded sort of working poor parents who were trying to move up in the world, tricked them into thinking that he had started a top-notch real estate investment school, and then fleeced them of their cash. And there's all these, just the number of scandals that one would think would be presidency-defining or destroying, both with regard to stuff that's linked to Russia and not, is, you know, immense. There's a whole cornucopia of scandals that are not at all disputed, that are directly out in the open. And so it is sort of a dizzying to focus on this very improbable charge that did, admittedly, from some quarters, get too much attention, and then to act as though this has, you know, cleared the cloud that hangs over the Trump administration when, as we know, the Southern District of New York is still investigating the president for alleged potential tax crimes, for his fraudulent charity, and for a variety of other things. So misrepresenting the value of his properties on tax filings. The man is still in a tremendous amount of legal trouble, and has already, the Mueller investigation has already resulted in criminal convictions of his personal attorney, his first national security advisor, and one of his 2016 campaign managers. Under a different presidency, we would think that, I think that this would be a pretty significant, that this would not be a vindication of the president, but that is how it's currently being spun.
Well, but that was how clever Barr is. He auditions for the job, gets the job, and essentially, my assumption is he took the job literally to protect the Republican brand. He's been able to kind of control what the Mueller report says in its initial salvo, and in doing so, limit the damage enormously. And now the Democrats are in a situation where they've got all these House investigations. And as I mentioned earlier, the Republicans will be saying, well, why are we wasting taxpayer money on these pointless investigations? He's already been cleared, and you Democrats are just being petty and vindictive, as you were with the Kavanaugh hearings, which also backfired on the Democrats. So how are they going to get out from under this?
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure that I don't think it's 100% clear that the Kavanaugh hearings backfired. I think that they were polarizing and probably hurt the Democrats in some rural areas where basically I think it mobilized both parties' bases, that you have the suburban professional base of the Democratic Party, the suburban professional female base that was energized by the Kavanaugh spectacle, and then the Republican evangelical Christian right base that was also mobilized, and that had probably helped Democrats a little bit in the House and hurt them in the Senate. And that I think is sort of related to this in terms of, you know, opinion about Trump and about whether Trump is being treated fairly is already so cemented. There was a poll a couple months ago that showed 58% of voters saying that they're definitely not going to vote for Trump in 2020. Probably some of those people are lying to themselves or to pollsters, and that they will find a reason to dislike the Democratic nominee. But overall, people generally know how they feel about Trump pretty strongly. And there is a majority in the country that would like to see him held to account. There's still large majorities in polls that want to see his taxes, which does require Democratic investigations or requests and subpoenas to release. And the other thing that I mentioned in the piece is that fundamentally, I don't think that the Russia scandal is Trump's biggest political liability. For reasons you sort of alluded to, Trump never presented himself during the campaign as like a very ethical campaigner, that this is a guy who's not going to do everything he can to win, that actually he's going to honor certain codes of conduct in trying to win elections. He actually ran very explicitly on the opposite, that he would attack your family, he would call your wife ugly as a dog, he would accuse your father of having been involved in the Kennedy assassination if that's what it took to beat you. And so it doesn't really detract from the persona he's chosen to put forward to say this guy accepted help from the Russian government, nor did he campaign as somebody who wasn't soft on Russia. He put that out there pretty explicitly. What he did campaign as is a populist who would take on the globalist elite in both parties who were robbing our working class and funneling profits away from productive industry to Wall Street and international investors. And on that account, there's a lot of scandals within his administration and within his personal professional life that really undercut that image by showing how much he has, in fact, been out for his own personal financial interests, his family's financial interests, and the financial interests of the economic class, the super rich that he belongs to.
Aspires to belong to.
Well, he's still in the 1%. He's still got a, you know, he's not.
He may be a billionaire. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But just in closing, though, Eric, my concern is that another 4 years of this guy after 2020 will be 8 years of global warming denial, and we just don't have that kind of time not to be dealing with this, because it's been 30 years since Al Gore and Bill McKibben warned us about it, and nothing's been done, and we just don't have the luxury of time. So that's a global tragedy in the making. But the other one is that you can see from this team of grifters he has in the cabinet how there has been complete regulatory capture. And Elaine Chao, the wife of Mitch McConnell, Transportation Department, is absolutely a corrupt example of it, where they let Boeing go ahead and certify their own aircraft. There was no oversight. And this has led to these crashes. And Boeing is one of the most successful American brands. And I think that at the end of the day, that's what's going to – we're going to be turned into a banana republic. American products are going to be less and less attractive abroad. Nobody listens to this Secretary of State or this ridiculous National Security Advisor, both of whom are liars, both of whom believe in the rapture, for God's sake. And nobody believes in Trump. So that's where the damage, I think, is going to be done to America's becoming a banana republic. Products will become less attractive abroad. Our soft power will evaporate. And nobody wants to deal with the leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're running a really interesting experiment right now, which is, you know, if we forfeit our soft power, what do we have? Do we need to actually act in a rational diplomatic way on the world stage, or does the fact that we have the world's largest military by several times, and that we have for now the world's reserve currency, the most attractive currency to foreign investors, because we have such a large consumer market and economy, can we just kind of glide on that and just make people deal with whatever, make people eat crap? So make our European allies, who we just promised could start investing in Iran because we had reached this nuclear agreement, can we tell them, actually, you know what, no, you gotta, your businesses have to just take your losses and get out of there, even though they're complying with the agreement because we said so, or else we'll cut off all your access to the U.S. banking system. Can we just do that? Can we just throw our weight around and get away with it? And I think in the short term, we can, but in the long term, no matter what we do, we're going to probably be in relative decline for the foreseeable future because China has way more people than we do and is continuing at a nice clip in terms of its industrialization. And we are eventually going to be in a multipolar world where we can't throw our weight around like that. And I think that Trump is putting us in a bad position for that world.
Well, Eric Levitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Levitz, who writes for New York Magazine's Daily Intelligencer, where his latest article is What Mueller's Apparent Dud Means for Democrats. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the photo op today in the White House and whether Trump's incredible popularity in Israel will rub off on Prime Minister Netanyahu facing a tough re-election in 2 weeks' time.
You want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you got to tell the truth, yeah?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Shibri Talhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, who has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group and as a senior advisor to the United States Department of State. He's the author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. And his forthcoming book is Between Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump, Evangelicals, Politics, and Israel. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Trump is too pro-Netanyahu for his own base. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shibli Talhami.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you. And it would seem to me, at least, Shibli, that what happened today in the White House with Donald Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel was very much a photo opportunity for the evangelicals. I think something like 2/3 to 3/4 of American Jewry vote Democratic. So are we at a point now where the so-called Christian Zionist coalition here in the United States is a more important pro-Israel, particularly pro-right-wing Israel, since Netanyahu is their prime minister, and he's just put an even far, far right group into his coalition. Is that ultimately what this display today was for?
Well, first of all, it is clear that there is sort of a love affair between Trump and Netanyahu based on political opportunism. Trump is very popular in Israel. In fact, Pew polls show him show Trump to be unpopular in most of the world, but he's particularly popular in Israel. And polls that I have done among Americans in recent years, including among Republicans and especially evangelicals, Netanyahu is one of the most popular leaders in the world, in fact, second only to Donald Trump now. And so clearly the evangelical Christians have become a big constituency supporting a pro-right-wing Israeli policy. And they have, in fact, admired Netanyahu dating back really to the Obama years when Netanyahu spoke more like a Republican, took on Obama, particularly on the Iran nuclear deal. And that's when, in fact, we saw him become, for evangelicals, the most popular leader in 2015 around the world, even surpassing Ronald Reagan. So in some ways, yes, there is that sort of win-win for Trump and Netanyahu. But let's not lose sight of this here. This is far more for Bibi than it is for Trump. It is much more for the Israeli prime minister, who is facing a tough fight in the upcoming Israeli election just a little over 2 weeks from now. And the Trump administration is pulling all the stops to get him reelected. So many different steps that they have taken just in the last few weeks. Pompeo went to the region trying to kind of demonstrate American Trump administration support for Israel on the Iran issue. They pulled together a conference in Poland to show that the prime minister of Israel can make peace with the Arab countries and appear in the same conference with Arab countries without having to compromise on the Palestinian question. And, you know, Netanyahu has run billboards in Israel showing him with Trump and has been making the pitch that his relationship with Trump is so close that he can get pretty much anything he wants. And clearly this photo op meeting today coming with a decision for the Trump administration to disregard international law and out of nowhere recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Syrian occupied Golan Heights. And it just intended more to help Netanyahu. Now, does it also help Trump? That's the question, given what we just said about the support for Trump within the Republican Party, but especially among evangelicals. I have a piece today in the foreign policy that argues that, in fact, Trump is too pro-Netanyahu, even for his own base. Netanyahu is still popular among the base, and frankly, a majority of Republicans and evangelicals in particular want the U.S. to take Israel's side in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but not as much as Trump has done. In fact, one of the things that we find in the polling in the U.S. on this issue is that while 57% of Republicans want Trump to take Israel's side, 71% say he's in fact doing so, and that's suggesting a level of discomfort. We find that in a number of other issues, including generational changes taking place, and that is particularly true of evangelicals. Well, we find that evangelicals who are under 35 and considerably less pro-Israel than those over 35. And in fact, many of them not only are less pro-Israel, but have become pro-Palestinian, in fact, roughly divided equally among those below 35, slightly more in favor of Israel, but noticeably a decline from older evangelicals. So in some ways, I think what Trump is doing is not directly a response to pressure from evangelicals. He has given the evangelicals everything they want on every other issue. They love him for it. Pew just released another poll today in which 69% approval rating of the president. It is still a drop, by the way, from where it was before. So they still support him in great numbers. But there is decline, and there is a decline also related to Israel. And I think that there's a level of discomfort within the Republican Party. Maybe Trump is embracing the Israeli prime minister way too much for their comfort level. And that's without taking into account a couple of visible things. That is that you are talking about a prime minister who has been recommended for indictment for corruption by the attorney general, serious charges against him, someone who has entered into a brokered a coalition with a right-wing racist party who's made up of followers of Meir Kahani, whose movement was considered to be terrorist even by Israeli standards. So we see all these things that could come back to haunt the Trump administration. But for now, I think, sure, evangelicals and Republicans support his Trump stand on Israel, but I think there is a noticeable level of discomfort that could surface in the future.
And again, I'm speaking with Shibli Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, who has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations and on the Iraq Study Group, and as a senior advisor to the U.S. Department of State. He's the author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and The Reshaping of the Middle East. And his forthcoming book is Between Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump, Evangelicals, Politics, and Israel. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Trump is too pro-Netanyahu for his own base. So given that Trump is incredibly popular in Israel, and I take it that's across the board, left and right, and I noticed that one of the people running against running against Netanyahu, Yair Lapid, also praised Trump's recognition of Israel's annexation of the 500-square-mile plateau known as the Golan Heights, which has been under Israel control since 1967. So if he's incredibly popular, Trump, in Israel, how is that going to impact this very close election? I mean,
It's a good question. And certainly, obviously, Netanyahu hopes that this is going to help him. And he's probably right, because you're right. I mean, the popularity is across the board. And I did a poll in Israel myself last year where I found a majority of Israelis have a favorable view of Trump, and that's across the board. Even secular Israelis who tend to be more liberal politically have more favorable views of Trump than unfavorable views of him, and we see that. But down again, even there, there's a level of discomfort. No one is going to come and be less pro-Israeli than an American president. So if you're a candidate, even if you don't think it's a good idea right now to recognize Israeli sovereignty, you can't not say you're for it. But frankly, a lot of people may be uncomfortable, meaning there's no pressure on Israel to pull out of the Golan Heights now. I mean, Syria has just gone through civil war. There's a lot of security issues. No one is clamoring to put pressure on Israel to pull out now. But there's a big difference between saying, well, they don't need to pull out now versus you're going to recognize the sovereignty of Israel over a territory that is considered to be Syrian by the international community, where even Israeli prime ministers in the past, including Netanyahu himself in the late 1990s, when he negotiated through interlocutors with the Assad regime on the basis of withdrawing from the Syrian territories. So people aren't really, I don't know that this helps Israel, this sovereignty recognition, because it raises more questions to them. It puts the issue on the front burner where it wasn't. And yeah, maybe Netanyahu could reap some political benefits out of that. But clearly, Israel itself is divided. I did another poll there last week. I wrote a piece on how the Arab population in Israel is likely to vote, and they're really anger with the Netanyahu government that they're likely to turn out to vote in larger numbers, in part to make sure that he loses. We also see that polls show very close race between Netanyahu's party, Likud, and this blue and white party that is more centrist, with Netanyahu actually trailing a little bit in most polls. So frankly, while people can't say they're less pro-Israel than the president of the United States, they also feel uncomfortable, not only in terms of the strategic picture they're put into, but also because they think the president is meddling in the domestic politics in a way that could hurt them. So they're put in a bind. That's exactly what Netanyahu hopes. But it isn't necessarily going to be a major factor in the outcome of the election. And I think more will be a function of what happens now in the escalation in Gaza in the past few hours, and whether there's more escalation, whether we have a ceasefire agreement that reduces the confrontation, that is more likely to have an impact on the elections than this photo op between the president and the prime minister of Israel.
And of course, speaking of interfering in other people's elections, that's certainly what Netanyahu's done. And I think that has also offended a lot of liberal Jewish American voters who saw the way.
Undoubtedly. In fact, what's interesting is I'm really glad you said that, because I was going to say that the Pew poll that was released today, and I had mentioned that 69% of evangelicals have a high approval rating of President Trump. Only 24% of American Jews, I think it's the lowest of any other group other than Muslims, 18%. So American Jews don't like Trump. They're liberal. They're more in the Democratic Party. And they also don't like many of his policies on Israel. Not that they support Israel, but they don't necessarily support right-wing Israel. And they don't support the prime minister of Israel, who's angered many of them, particularly his moves in recent weeks, the support of the so-called nation-state law that has declared Israel as a a Jewish state without reference to democracy and its non-Jewish citizens that gave Jews privileges over non-Jews in Israel. Very anti-democratic basic law, which is like a constitutional law. And certainly his moves in terms of aligning himself with racist right-wing partners. And so in that sense, there's a divide between American Jews and the Prime Minister of Israel, and it's increasing as we speak.
Well, just in closing, of course, you mentioned that this flare-up with Gaza could impact the elections, and even though the blue-white coalition of three former army chiefs of staff and former finance ministers is doing remarkably well. Of course, there is a symbiosis between the hawks led by Netanyahu and the hawks in Iran and, by extension, the hawks in Gaza. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past those boneheaded people to provoke something. I think they're paradoxically happier to have somebody like Netanyahu running Israel as opposed to more reasonable people like Lapid and Benny Gantz.
Well, it's hard to know, and it's hard to know where, you know, Lapid and Benny Gantz are on this issue. Frankly, they've actually baited the prime minister a little bit over the rocket yesterday from Gaza, where they said, you know, essentially hasn't been tough enough on Gaza. So and they're, of course, coming, particularly Gantz, coming out of the military. He wants to flaunt his credentials, and he's been rather tough on this issue. So it's hard to know where people are. But it's a political season. I mean, Ian, I mean, you know what it's like in the U.S. It's the same way there. And you have essentially a prime minister who's seen universally as a person who will do almost anything to keep office and stay out of jail, and that's what he's doing, and he's pulling all the stops
right.
And do so.
Forgive me for chuckling. It sounds very much like our president.
Exactly. Well, you know, they're very similar in that way.
Right. Get another 4 years so that you can be protected and not be indicted. I thank you for joining us. Appreciate it, Shibli Tilhami.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Shibli Tilhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, who has served as an advisor to the U.S. mission, to the UN, and served on the Iraq Study Group, and as a senior advisor to the U.S. Department of State. He's the author of The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion, and the Reshaping of the Middle East, and his forthcoming book is Between Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump, Evangelicals, Politics, and Israel. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Trump is too pro-Netanyahu for his own base. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Bye.